this is the way we will work the procedure. I'm going to introduce all three of the men all at once, and then I'll hand the mic over. And each of them will just tell a story or two or anything they want to tell us about their memory of Thurlie and the 306. And when all three have done so...
Who else is going? Well, Corrigan, he's going. But how many are there? No, we're all going to the 100th group. Can't you get the orders changed? Come with us? I don't know how to change orders. But later I found out why they were all going to the 100th group, because the 100th group were decimated. The Germans had their target, and they're shooting out the 100th group, and that's why they needed all the replacements. But the 306 wasn't that bad, and so he came in, just two crews came into the 306, and there were 369 who were assigned to that, and we flew out of there with that. And I flew the tour of 32 missions. First it was 25, just like you had it, and then they raised it to 30, and then Doolittle came in command. He said, hey, these guys are all good pilots now. Why do we let them go home? So he raised it to 35, and there's almost a riot. Oh, wait, Charlie, you're right. We'll prorate your time, so you only have to do two more after 30. I said, oh, okay, settle for that. But that was my tail end of the training. And my brother, who was 70 years older, was stationed there. He was with General Patton. He was a supply officer. And he would drive around England picking up supplies and lining things up. And he came out to the base. He knew where the plane was. And one day he came out there. And I said, well, we're going on a mission now, but we'll be back. And it's a short mission. We'll be back in a couple of hours. You going to wait? He said, no, I don't think I'll wait. I'll see you later. It was another, wait a minute. Look, we got an extra parachute. We're not going into altitude. And why don't you come with us? Hey, that's not a bad idea. So I took the logbook and put his name down. I gave it down to the engineer down on the ground. I said, hold this book, because I'm going to take this name off when we come back. And so he came in and he flew with us. He was so thrilled that here he was flying on a mission and seeing the country, the France, from up in the air. And then when they were coming back, the bombardier was standing where my brother was standing. I said, where's my brother? He's sitting in my seat in the nose. Give him a good landing. Okay. Boom, da-boom, da-boom, da-boom. Taxied over, and I said, wow, what a landing. And then the bombardier said, this was a good one. Charlie really bringing in a bomb. And fortunately, the B-17 was a very forgiving airplane. It would take a beating. And unfortunately for me, it was that. And I was able to complete the tour and come out of there. And, also, when when I came home, and I told my sisters and my mother, my sister says, you took Ed on a mission with you? Why, sure, why not? He liked it. Your mother lost two sons if something happened to you two. I never gave it a thought. What an awful thing that would have been if we went down. I thought we were down, we could walk out of France together. But no, crazy things that I've done, and worked it out for me, and it worked out pretty well. I'm happy to come back.
All right, we'll pass the mic down.
All right.
Well, I started out at the age of 18, close to it, and I did get some signatures, you know, and got them on a piece of paper, and at that time they were looking for people, and six of them were taken. I enlisted, and as far as how old you was and the signature, they didn't pay too much attention to it. As long as you could walk in the door, say hello, okay, we got a place for you, you know? So that was the start of my affair with the service. And then the next place I went to, we had our exams and whatnot. And so when they checked all of the exams of all the people that took them, some of them went here, some of them went there. And I think it depended on what kind of a mark you got. And then they sent me to the Air Force. So that was the start of the situation. And then through the years, I went to different schools. I went to different training areas. They sent me up to Michigan State for a couple months to see if I, you know, could do anything and if I was qualified for a lot of stuff and so forth. And I went through a lot of different schools. And then finally, I was sent to Wendover, Utah. And that was in 1942. And that's just when we were assembling things out there. They may have had three or four B-17s out there, and that was about the most. And when we got out there, there was nothing much out there. There, you could, at nighttime, you could see a few jackrabbits, and that's about it. The rest of the thing was just bare desert, you know. You wondered what happened to you. Whether you were going to stay there or you wasn't. People kept coming in, and the pilots were coming in, co-pilots, and they had the engineers and so forth, and they were assembling crews as they came in from the school. At that time, it was early, middle of 42, and so as the engineers, the bombardiers, and they say, well, you're on this crew, you're on this crew, and they assembled them. Flying, we didn't do too much flying out there. I think the B-17, some of the pilots and co-pilots and navigator, it was pretty much their first shot at a bomber. And it was kind of shaky if you wanted to go up and ride, you know. You were wondering if you got off the ground whether you were going to come down all right, you know. And when, some of them were looking at this and looking at this instrument, you know, what is this, you know. It was the start was really quite a place. And then from there, the ground crew, we had the ground crew, we had office crews and so forth. And we assembled, and then there were eventually they were getting enough B-17, so they could bring them in, the pilots could get their crew together and so forth. I, as far as mostly, it was probably the officers that flew the plane, and maybe there might have been one enlisted man that went with them. And then the rest of them all, we were all shipped out on trains. We went to Fort Dix, and we spent some time down there. And then, next thing we knew, Queen Elizabeth was docked down there, and the Queen Elizabeth was waiting for us. So, and at the time, as I understand it, they put about 20,000 of us on that ship. And we had three shifts. One ship, they came out and ate and did their thing. They got back in their bed area. The guy up above them would come out. He would get his meal and do his thing. The guy on at the top, that he'd go do his thing, and that was pretty much the trip. Going over to England, and at that time, there was quite a few submarines in the area, and the Queen Elizabeth was fairly fast ship, and we were zigzagging all the way over so that the submarines, you know, couldn't really get a good hold on us or spot us and get their radar on us. And then we came over to England, and we come into Scotland, and then we got a ride in a train and went down to Thurlow, and that's where we had our the ships were coming in, and that's when we started bombing. And it was probably around the latter part of the year. I was getting maybe October, November, so forth. Then we started bombing. And the first place we were bombing were installations along the coastline. And that's where the submarine pins were. And we were trying to knock them out. We were over there bombing and so forth. And I suppose to some extent we created a little bit of havoc there, and that helped in turn to get our supplies over, because if we got enough of them out, they couldn't be out there in the ocean waiting for our ships to come in with supplies. And at one period there, when we first started bombing, somebody got the idea, well, we ought to try low altitude bombing. So the crews got together, and we went heading for the submarine pins again, low altitude, probably under 10,000 feet. And they thought that was going to be a great idea. But it didn't turn out to be such a big, great idea, because they had all their 20 millimeters and things down there, and they could reach us with those guns instead of the 100 millimeters or the 110 millimeters. And we come down through there, we thought we were, you know, going to have an easy ride, and all of a sudden, boom, 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 all those little guns started reaching us. And we just hustled through there and dropped the bombs and went back and told them the story, you know. I think this is about the last low altitude mission we ought to have, you know. Isn't that great? And there was times, you know, you wouldn't be flying on a mission. There might be a day or two in between or something like that, weather conditions and so forth. And my pilot and two others, well, we decided we'd go take a training flight. So they said, well, I guess they got permission to go out and go on a training flight. There were three planes that decided to go. But it turned out the boys said, well, we'll try something else. And what they tried was, let's go hedge hopping, you know. And we were maybe 100 feet off the ground. We were going up and down out over the trees, and we were having a great time. And and I think one plane kind of brushed the top of a tree. And the report came in. They said we were scaring half of the British people over there, you know. The chickens were flying everywhere, and people were running, and also, you know, and boy, the three boys had to go see the leader, you know. And they said, how come you picked this for a training mission, you know? Well, they didn't have no answer, so the three pilots were grounded for about 3 days before they could fly again. And that was a little incident we had. But the majority of my I was went over there in 42 latter part. And then in the middle of 43, I had completed my 25 missions. I was fortunate enough that I with one pilot, one plane, I completed about 21 missions, and then I completed probably the other four with some other crew, because maybe our plane wasn't flying, or the pilot wasn't in decent, healthy enough maybe to fly. And so when I, that was a story there, completing the 25, and then that was in the, probably the middle part of 43, and then all of a sudden I had my 25 missions in, and they jerked me right out and says, well, you're going to go home, you know. And I was the fifth one to complete 25 missions. Nobody had had been getting close to that, because, well, planes were down, planes had problems, crews, part of some crews, they didn't have a full load, they couldn't go, and all that kind of thing. There was, and a lot of them were lost in the battles. I mean, there was, back then, the Germans, they had all kinds of Focke-Wulfs and Messerschmitts, and they always greeted us. And the anti-aircraft was there, and they were busting all around us and so forth. So it was a lucky situation. But we had a good system to get there and try to get back. We had escort maybe just across the channel in there a little ways, because the plane back there didn't have the fighter planes and our escorts, they didn't have the range at that time, and they couldn't go in very far. So we had them, and sometimes they would, when we were coming back and there was a report that there was a straggler or something, and they would, if there were fighters in there following them, then they could go in a little ways and protect the ship. And the thing is, at times you had a lot of stragglers. A lot of planes got hit. A lot of planes lost engines. A lot of so forth. And once you slowed down and you couldn't keep up, the main planes, they were heading home. You know, they couldn't wait for you. And you just got left out there, but you did the best you could to get back. And if you had to, you could ditch into the channel, and then you had life-saving boats that you could pop them out and wait for maybe somebody, some of the rescue boats that are along the channel, and they heard about you, they would come and help you out and bring you in. There was times that we would go on a mission, do our job, come back, and Thurlight would be clouded in, and we couldn't land. So we'd have to find some other place to land and spend the night, and then wait till the fog and the clouds cleared off, and then we would go back. So I was lucky, our plane, the same plane, to make 21, 22 missions on it. You know, we had a good crew, everybody did their job. And through that process, a good pilot, and we were able to ward off the fighters, kind of get away from the anti-aircraft, and it was a good situation. But I also saw times in there where a crew would come in, it was the first trip, and you'd say hello and give them a little information, and then you'd check when you got home, and they weren't there. They were lost on their, they got knocked down on their first mission. And it was those kind of things that would happen that would annoy. Okay.
Charles, how about giving it back to George Roberts? We haven't heard as much from him yet.
Well, let me say a couple things here because I want to make sure we get the context here. Now, Nick, as you may have guessed, was there as one of the original crews. And if you remember from your 12 o'clock high days of watching that film, Charles Overacker was the commanding officer. And it was during the time that Nick was there that Overacker was relieved of command. And that whole story, that opening sequence of the film took place. These missions that were flown in the fall of 1942, and just before Armstrong took over, morale plummeted. It was very difficult. Losses were very high. And on top of that, I think conditions at Thurlow were not good. The airfield was not finished. There was a lot of mud. It was just morale was plummeting. And Nick sort of lived through all that, and survived, of course. A lot of them did not. George, did you want to say something additional?
I don't know what to say. I'd like to talk about 12 o'clock high for just a minute.
That would be wonderful. There you go.
I was fascinated by the film. In 1949, I saw it in St. Louis. In 1949, about 1953, the Air Force Historical Society put out an article on the making of 12 o'clock high. It's about 50 pages long. And I got a copy from, I don't know, some Air Force thing in California. And read it and reread it, and I was so fascinated by it because really it was the story of the 306 bomb group. Everybody will deny it if they were from another group, but it really was. And in 1958, I was transferred from Illinois to Keesler Air Force Base, Mississippi, to Gulfport. And the first thing I did was take a tour. And I went to Mariester, Florida, where Gregory Peck and the rest of them stayed. Then I went to Eglin Air Force Base, where they took a lot of stills. Then I went to the old Hunter Base, where the plane crashed as the scene opened. Then I went to Eglin Air Force Base 2, which is on US 85 between the interstate and US 90, where they reconstructed the field to look like Thurlow, where they did most of the shooting. So It was just like going home to me. And not only that, for anybody who was in Thurlow during the war and really was participated in flying, it's the only movie I have ever seen that really portrays what life was like during World War II in the 8th Air Force. Of all the other, I've seen them all, Memphis, Belle, and all the rest of them, but this one was the first picture that actually portrayed life like it was. The only thing I disagreed with it was they were too liberal in saying that anybody could go on a mission by sneaking on the airplane. I couldn't see that. I don't know how to listen. First of all, I didn't see that many people wanted to get in the plane with me, at least on the missions I went on. The other thing was, how life changes. When I came in the Air Force, I said, just gung-ho, let's get this war over with. And when I finished with radio school, they had a sign, he says, would you like to go to a control tower, so forth. And I got to talking to some of my friends, they said, well, we're in the Air Force, we ought to fly. So, okay, let's fly, we'll go to gunnery school. So we took an examination from our gunnery school, and the weight limit was 180 pounds, and I weighed 183 pounds, so I failed. So I said,
than a man. Isn't there some way I can get around this? Because we three fellows have all been together. He says, well, if you can lose that 3 pounds by Monday, I'll give you a retest. So I went to the Belcher Health Club in St. Louis, and I came back and took that test, and I weighed 177 pounds. You talk about sweating. I was in a sauna for 2 days. So I went to Laredo, Texas, and completed my gunnery exercises and shooting the targets and all that stuff, and was assigned to Utah, Salt Lake City. By the way, if you've ever been to Salt Lake City, it's a beautiful, beautiful place. And they treated us like millionaires. We couldn't pay to get into a movie or a ball game. Everything was free for the veterans. But when it comes to shipping out, I went to dental examination, and the doctor says, you can't leave till you get teeth. You're missing too many teeth. By the way, they're the one that took them. And so my friends left, and that's the last I ever saw. But I shipped out, I guess about a week later, and I went to Blythe Air Force Base. And just as I got there, they were finishing up, so I spent exactly 3 days in phase one in Blythe Air Force Base. And then we went to phase two and phase three and all the rest of it. Now the next thing I want to remember is this gung-ho attitude I had. Let's get this war over. Boy, can't wait to get in that airplane and get the first mission. And the first mission is to Bremen. And I said, lead me on. And of course, when the mission started and the fighters started coming in, and I started aiming that gun. And by the way, I was a radio operator, so my best target was the tail of our own plane. But I saw that fighter ship, and I says, that damn fool's trying to kill me. And I says, look, buddy, I have no quarrel with you. You leave me alone, and I'll leave you alone. All we want to do is drop our bombs and get out of here. Now, that's how naive a young fellow is when he starts something like the war till he really sees the seriousness of it. And from that's the day that I grew up as far as fighting a war, was after that first mission. Of course, after that, you didn't get used to it, but you knew it was going to come. While I flew my missions, of course, the main thing was fighting. Fighters were deathly. But outside of that, I would say this. My Air Force experience was one of the greatest moments of my life. The days I spent in active duty at the Air Force, I think every young man ought to experience what I had. Not the death and the injuries and all that, but just the life. I made friends in the military that I would have never met outside. Friends that would give their life for me. You just don't know. I said, when I go on a mission, I said, Lord, you get me back from this one, I'll never go on another one. And I meant it. But the next day when the call came, believe me, it was harder to stay on the ground than it was to get in that airplane with your crew. I had one fellow on my crew that quit after the fourth mission. He had far greater nerve and courage than I ever had. But he finally confessed to me, he says, I'm not afraid for myself, I'm afraid I will fail to do my duty and let somebody else down, and it will cause their injury or their death. So those kind of things made me grow up and made me really appreciate the years that the Air Force gave me.
Okay, we're going to open this up to questions for George, Nick, or Charlie. To the audience, anyone have a question? I'll pass the mics down if you'll tell me who Barbara?
An initial question to get the timeline here. I know, Nick, you got there by November, you were flying, and you were done by sometime in May of 43. And then, George, you got there in September of 43.
And I finished up end of July at 44.
July 44. And then,
I mean, it was spring of 44, and I was out by July 44.
What
happened? We need to get a six-month service right now.
Quite a segment here from early 42 in the States to July 44.
Now, did your brother, Charlie, ever complain that you only took him up on one mission, so he was four missions short of an air medal?
Oh, that's right. I didn't mention that.
Any other questions?
A silly one for Mr. Bannis. It was Jones Field you trained at?
Jones, yeah.
Put it up real close to your mouth.
Bonham, Texas.
In Bonham, Texas.
Okay.
That was a private school.
I know.
That they contracted the airport.
John Zeeks grew up in Bonham, Texas. The way
you're
he got
familiar
around.
With that?
The 369.
Yes. Very good.
Others?
I just have a question about the living conditions on base. You were in the slept in the Quonset huts. The officers were in one section and the enlisted men in another. But was it all sort of the same conditions? Like you might like. Tell me what's the difference.
I don't remember the number. The number would be located in the Quonset hut for the enlisted men or for the officers. But they had, I guess, about a dozen men in the Quonset hut. We had one pot-belly stove in the center.
Just like the picture.
That was our source of heat. Mm-hmm. Now, the other facilities we go through with the mess hall and all, they had a mess hall for the enlisted men and for the officers.
So two separate ones.
Yes, there were two separate, because they ate off of tin plates, I shouldn't say this, and we had china. the situation there, but it wasn't really discriminatory. They were going along, but going together. Now I'll tell you one thing about the airfield facilities for sanitation were very awkward, because we had a bomb shelter not too far from the Quonset hut. And nobody would go in there when there was an air raid, because it smelled so bad. It was used as a latrine. And people would rather take the bombs outside. Now, but they had them around the base. There were little outhouses, and they had the honey dippers. I don't know if you ever want to hear about the honey dippers. There were two gentlemen that drove the truck. They wore suits, white shirt, and tie. And they get out of the truck and put on the smock and a pair of gloves, and they have to change these buckets that are in the outhouses. And they pick up one and put in a clean one. And that was done periodically throughout the base, because we had the plumbing facilities weren't that good.
All right, so you're talking about a bucket.
Yes.
Right. Like a bucket that could carry.
Right. And it was water to receive the discharge, and they had a coating of oil over the top of it so the odors wouldn't come up. And then they had to change these buckets periodically, and we call them the honey dippers.
And so even in the coldest winter,
yeah. We don't want to go there. Before we continue on another question,
yeah.
Why don't you pass it to Nick, because Nick was there so early and conditions were so primitive. I wonder what Nick remembers about conditions in his own Neeson hut and around.
Well, in the Neeson hut, we had our cot, and we assigned there. And the one that I was in, we could have had 30 men in there somewhat, you know. It was a large one, just something for us. We had a little potbelly stove on one end, and if there happened to be coke around, we could start a fire and burn it for a little while, and that was the extent of the heat and so forth. In the cold weather, in the winter time, we used to suffer there. I one time asked for, I wanted 5 blankets, you know? So I got 5 blankets somehow or another. And it still didn't keep me warm, you know? It was damp and cold and so forth in the winter time. No heat, you know? That those were the conditions. And we were, when we went on a mission, they come in and blew the whistle and 3-4 o'clock in the morning. And we had to get up and dress in the cold weather and so forth and hope for the best, you know. And then we'd get on the truck and then we'd go get a little something to eat. And after we got something to eat, then we went to the briefing room. What we're going to do, and where we're going to go, and so forth. What the weather was. And then after that, we'd get in the truck again. We'd go get our parachutes. Or the bombardier get his bombardier, or his sight, bomb sight, the Norton bomb sight. That had to come out of the airplane every time it landed. And then the bomb sight was put in every time we went. And then there was the ammunition thing. We had to make sure we had 200-300 rounds of ammunition and so forth. And the plane wasn't warm either, you know. It wasn't too bad. The first planes, the windows, the side windows where the waste gunners were, they just opened up and so forth and let the cold air in. And the situation was, at 10,000, when we got up to 10,000 feet, then we had to go on oxygen. We had a small mask on our face and so forth. And then as we kept going up and up, if we got up at our bombing altitude, it could be 60 below zero up there, cold. And in places in the plane, it was real cold. Some of the people had the leather jackets on with sheepskin on the inside. They had the pants, and so forth. And the worst thing was that about that, in the waste, when they had that open area, sometimes your oxygen could freeze up on you. And you'd have to go around, get out of there, and go and get your oxygen taken care of so you could breathe again. Well, that was kind of the thing in the plane. Now, I mean, we were over there, we were doing the job, but we also had our good time too, you know. They said the Yanks are here and watch them, you know. That was the system over there, you know. And they're tricky, you know. Well, whatnot. And when I first went over there, I bought stuff and I had to change and whatnot. And I'd say, well, here, I want that. Help yourself, you know. And they sure as hell did. I hand right out, you know. And they were looking for more, you know. It was that situation. Now,
in the mornings, when you were going on a mission, I've been led to believe, and I'm not sure it's accurate or not, but you pretty much had to shave before every mission because the mask would chafe your face. Was that the case?
No.
No. No. No.
Okay. That wasn't the case.
No. Whiskers are
you soft. Got up and you just shaved whenever you had the opportunity. You know?
I was thinking about trying to shave when it was that cold in the winter. Yeah.
I know. I mean, it was tough just getting out of bed, you know.
Bill, we have a question back there.
Talk to George.
Okay. Would you pass the mic down to George?
I heard a question about the barracks.
Hold it up close.
Picture of mine in it.
Hold the mic up.
Hold the mic up.
The one thing I can remember about the barracks, 4 windows, 2 at each end, and a block of wood that you put in and leave it in when it's nighttime. And when you come in through the one end that's built in with two doors. You shut the first door and come in, and then you open the second door after you close the first door. Behind the door, there's a panel, and every man in the barracks has his picture on the panel. And when somebody is shot down, you take that picture off and you put the new one on. As far as the beds are concerned, six are aligned this way and six right across from it. And at the end, where you have the double entry, there's a cot that 90 degrees opposite the rest of them. And these were the deluxe beds, those two. And as you stayed in the hut longer, you got a better chance of moving up to one of those two good beds.
Pecking order, right?
Is that right?
How are we doing on time, Charles?
George, we didn't get his question.
Hold on just a second.
You got about 10 minutes. We need
okay, we're going to go to Bill. Bill for the next question. It's kind of hard to move them back and forth. Say that again, please.
Now you got his letter from the Queen.
How'd you get to tell him how you got your letter from the Queen?
How did you get the letter from the Queen?
Oh.
Up close.
In England, if you're a native of England, and if you were married 60 years or longer, and you send a note to the Queen, she will write you a personal letter. And since I was born in England, I sent a letter to the Queen, and I included some pictures of her at the christening in 1944, a copy of our wedding certificate, and birth certificate of mine and my wife. And I got the nicest letter back saying that it appears that I was married in America and that my wife was an American, which is true. So I didn't get the picture, but I still got a nice note from her. So that was some years ago, but we'll soon be married 70 years. I won't try it again.
Let's close it out, but we've had a real good panel today. We had two good panels the last 2 days, so we've got 9 men and some others that have participated in other reunions. So I encourage you to grab them and ask them more questions in the hospitality room, sit with them during the banquet, and continue this conversation. Thank you for your attention. Thanks, guys. Thanks, George.
You know, I'll tell you something. You were...
What's the matter?
Nothing. I got back at you. Doctor, I've known you forever.
Thanks, Charlie.
I just...
Hey, Nick. Nick, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, man. Here's this. That's still on. I've turned this one off.